Good morning. We here at the Biblical Institute are very pleased to welcome Professor Gary Randsburg, the Blanche and Irving Laurie Chair in Jewish History at Rutgers University. His teaching and research focus, to quote what he likes to say about his own work, all things ancient Israel, primarily language and literature, though also history and archaeology. His undergraduate work was in English literature, which gives him a unique perspective during his later training in classical Hebrew that resulted in his book, Diglossia in Ancient Hebrew. One of his books was not on the shelf, and no one had left the card either to say where the book was. So I have almost all of his books here. His first book, of course, The Redaction of Genesis, and then the Diglossia in Ancient Hebrew, Linguistic Evidence for the Northern Origin of Selected Psalms. I think I may have them in order, yes. The Bible and the Ancient Near East, co-authored with Cyrus Gordon, great name. It's also in Polish. This book is in Polish and Hungarian. Israelite, Hebrew and the Book of Kings. And this is Israelite, Hebrew and the Book of Kings. The Bible World, and then Leheman Zioni. This is Essays in Honor of Zioni Zevit. His next book, which is about to appear, and I have the flyers, it'll appear next month, is How the Bible is Written, and that is what Professor Randsburg is going to speak about today. You can find his 45-page bibliography online. He is currently working on the JPS commentary on the books of Samuel. And as you can see, Professor Randsburg, you are looking at the audience of the people who will be reading your commentary. So we're very grateful for the time you take in solitude and silence, reflecting and meditating on the Word of God. We are the audience who reads your work. Professor Randsburg, if I could just speak for a moment personally, is the son of a Holocaust survivor. His father was deported to Auschwitz, then to Buchenwald, and then to Theresienstadt. His grandparents survived the war in Potenza, where he and Melissa, his wife, will be visiting after they leave Rome. They will also visit the town of Oppido, where Johannes of Oppido lived, known as Obadiah, the proselyte. He was a Catholic monk who converted to Judaism in the year 1102. Johannes of Oppido, Obadiah the proselyte's biography is found in the Cairo Geniza. Professor Randsburg has worked to make these documents available, and they are available online. So if you Google his name, you will see a link, and I encourage you to do it. Johannes of Oppido, or Obadiah the proselyte, is a fascinating person, and you can see the original documents and a transliteration translation. If I might speak personally for just a moment, we visited the Vatican Library on Tuesday morning, where Professor Randsburg was able to hold the manuscripts he has studied and knows very well. When the librarian handed him Targum Neophyti, I thought, there is the Targum created by a Jewish community reflecting on their history and their relationship with God. It has found itself in its rightful hands. What a contrast to so many dark periods in Roman history, remembering the year 1550, when Jewish books were burned in Campo dei Fiori. We are very honored that you are here this morning, Professor Randsburg, and haven't taken time out of what is a bit of work and also mostly a vacation. We are also grateful to your lovely wife, Melissa, for sharing this time, sharing you with us, giving us this time. His lecture, of course, is the title of his book that will appear next month. You can already pre-order it on Amazon.com. So welcome, Gary and Melissa Randsburg.
Thank you so much, Craig, for that absolutely beautiful, wonderful, and warm and personal introduction. Thank you all for attending this morning. It is an absolute honor and pleasure. pleasure and privilege to be here at the Biblicum and to meet colleagues, some of whom I haven't seen in years, meet new colleagues, and all of the students who are here together. It is an absolute special pleasure for me to be here for several personal reasons. I started my academic career at a Jesuit college, Canisius College in Buffalo, New York. Newly minted PhD, as we say in English, at the age of 26. And here I was, a young scholar of ancient Judaism and ancient Israel, hired by the Jesuits to teach Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, and comparative religion at a Jesuit college. And the Jesuits who gave me my start in my academic career is something that I hold dear, ad hayom hazeh, until this day. And then, early in my career, I published a series of articles in the two journals which are edited here, Biblica and Orientalia, four of them in Biblica and two of them in Orientalia. And I haven't published again in either of those journals in many, many years. The time has passed. Too many years have passed, so I promise to submit something again to either Biblica or Orientalia. In those years, there was no email, of course, so you actually had to take your printed article and manuscript and put it in an envelope. And how often did I write Piazza della Pilota 25 and send it off to Rome and wait 2 months maybe for the response and so on. And here I am outside in the piazza this morning, so a real personal pleasure to do that. And finally, to mention, as Professor Morrison did, my teacher Cyrus Gordon was very, very close to colleagues here at the Biblicum, especially Pater Alfred Pohl, whose name I hope still resonates here. And in the last edition of his Ugaritic textbook, 1965, 1967, although then it was updated with some later printings by Professor Chianto's assistants, the dedication is to the memory of Pater Professor Alfred Pohl, S.J. And so I was raised knowing about the great traditions here through my own teacher, Cyrus Gordon. And then, as I said, having my own experiences in a Jesuit community as well. So I can end my introduction by all I can say. The only Hebrew word that comes to mind is, like Abraham, like Jacob, and like Moses, Hineni, which I looked up in the Italian translation, Eccomi, is that correct? Here I am. Grazie. Thank you very much, everyone. So you have a very extensive handout, which tries in 1 hour to summarize a very large book, How the Bible is Written, which I have been working on now for 10 years, and I'm very grateful to expect its publication in the next month or so. And so what I want to do is give you a sense of what the book is about. And even though you all have the handout, okay, why? I'm trying to get it larger.
Just on the mouse, I think, if you're just on the mouse.
Yeah. Usually there's a bar with a percentage.
You can really see if it's just on the mouse.
Oh, there we go. That's that. Perfect. Okay. Good size.
Is it large enough?
You all have the handout, but this way I can also project it and we can look at the passages if I need to point to something. So the Bible is written in a remarkable fashion, obviously over the course of hundreds of years, perhaps even 1,000 years, from the earliest biblical material to the latest biblical material. And all the authors, it seems, without exception, had an extraordinary talent for using the Hebrew language to create literature. And you don't have to read very far in the Bible to see that literary talent on display. And you start with the first verse. In fact, you start with the first two words. And I always feel badly for students of Hebrew when you start learning Hebrew And you learn about the construct clause, the construct phrase, and you take two nouns and you put them together so you can say Beit HaMelech, the house of the king, and all those things. And it's always two nouns, and that's the way Hebrew works. And then you open up to finally read some Hebrew in the Bible itself, and the first words you read are Bereshit Bara, which violates the laws of Hebrew that you've just been taught. Because the first word is a noun and the second word is a verb, and yet here you have a construct. And so this is a grammatical conundrum, Bereshit Bara, and in my English translation I have tried to capture that, in the beginning of God created, which of course makes no grammatical sense in English either, but I wanted to capture the conundrum, the puzzle there of the opening words of the Bible. And I think that this sets the stage for you as a reader to pay attention to the very words that are being used here by these remarkable literati. And there is a parallel to this in Hosea chapter 1, verse 2. This was pointed out very early on by Jewish commentators in the Middle Ages, including Rashi. In his comment to Genesis 1:1, he says, have a look at Hosea 1:2, Techilat Diber. The beginning of the Lord spoke to Hosea, which again is grammatically the same, but doesn't make much sense in Hebrew or in English. And we're grateful for the parallel, but we'll just leave it at that, and just to remind us as to how difficult it is to work through these Hebrew passages, but they are intentionally difficult. And that's the main point I want to convey to you this morning. The text demands for you, the reader, which as we'll see is not a reader per se, but rather a listener, to engage with the words of the sacred text. Now, the first page here is all about Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to use Genesis 1, a very familiar text to all of us, to demonstrate some of these issues that I'm referring to here. So there's a refrain, there are several refrains, of course, that work through all of Genesis chapter 1. It always starts out with God did this or God said this. And then you have the refrain at the end that it was morning and it was, God saw that it was good, and it was morning and it was evening, day X, day, etc. And so there's the refrain, Vayar Elohim Ki Tov, and God saw that it was good. And this refrain occurs in every single creative act. On day one, twice on day three, day four, day five, twice on day six. And you'll notice that I skipped day two. The refrain does not occur in day two in the Masoretic text. And there you have chapter 1, verse 8, day 2, Vayikra Elohim l'rakia shamayim, vayihi erev, vayihi boker yom sheni. And there was evening and there was morning, a second day, but there's no, and God saw that it was good. This is not a mistake, although some of the versions supply the passage there, and God saw that it was good. This is an intentional omission from the author. And the reason for that is, although water was not created on day two, water was pre-existent according to the opening verses of Genesis chapter 1, but water is the main subject, or perhaps I should say the main object of God's creative act on day two, as God separates the water into the waters above and the waters below. And because the word waters, mayim, is used there so frequently in day two, and because those waters are the Israelite evocation of the ancient Near Eastern salt water chaos of Apsu, of Akkadian creation accounts and so on, which is a negative force in the universe according to the ancient Near Eastern cosmologies, the biblical author doesn't want you to think that God saw that it was good. It was all part of the pre-existent issues of the world. You could even call it pre-existent evil. And so the refrain is intentionally omitted there by our author, which allows you to consider why the refrain doesn't appear on day two. Now, if we move to day four, Genesis 1, verses 14 through 19, right here at the bottom. Now at the top. When God creates the two great lights on the fourth day, they are referred to as Hamaor Hagadol lememshelet hayom, ve'et Hamaor Hakaton lememshelet halayla, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. Now, everybody in this room knows that that refers to the sun and the moon. But would it not have been easier to use the Hebrew words Shemesh, and Yareach, sun and moon, instead of these long phrases that describe what the sun and moon are, but these terms are not used there. Again, a conscious decision not to use these words, because these words are, in the polytheistic world, pagan gods, the sun deity and the moon deity. And lest the naive reader think that somehow the one God is responsible for the creation of pagan deities, the author of Genesis 1 has consciously not used the words Shemesh and Yareach, which would be the names, as we know from Ugaritic texts, of the Canaanite sun and moon deities, an intentional usage. That also explains peculiarity in Genesis chapter 1, verse 10, where God creates the sea, ulemikveh hamayim kara yamim, and the gathering of the waters he called not yam in the singular sea, but yamim. Everything else is in the singular. When God creates things and names them, they're usually in the singular. So you have Eretz and Shemayim and so on. But here you have yamim, seas, which is a little bit peculiar. But I think, again, it's an intentional usage not to say the word yam, which of course would be the Canaanite sea god, again, well known from Ugaritic mythic texts. So this is what we would call demythologizing, a term which we usually associate in some way with 20th century scholarship on the New Testament, but I would actually use it here as well, following the lead, again, of my teacher Cyrus Gordon. The days of the week are all numbered, as we see here, days 1 through day 6. And I want to call your attention to the 6 days different from the others. It's Yom HaShishi. The others do not have the definite article, but on the 6th day, the text does give you the definite article. This is an intentional device, a device which I call variation to mark closure. I have a recent article on this in Vetus Testamentum and a chapter in the book on this subject, and we'll return to it later on. So instead of just the Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi, Yom Revi'i, Yom Hamishi, the author wants you to know that he and you, the reader, have reached the end of creation. And so Yom HaShishi is an intentional usage there. Similarly, top of the next page, the refrain by Yar Elohim Ki Tov, which we've seen throughout the days of creation, when you get to the final act of creation in verse 31, by Yar Elohim et kol asher asah vihine tov ma'od. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, vihine, very good, tov ma'od. Again, a change, an intentional change from the repetitious of this, that, or this. And instead you have a slight change at the end. Continuing into day 7 in chapter 2 with the creation of the Sabbath, notice that there is no mention of Shabbat in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. One of the great foundations of biblical Judaism, and the word Shabbat is not used. It will, be used later on in the book of Exodus and so on throughout the Tanakh, but it is not used. You think perhaps it might be used in creation account. It's not. Instead, you have Yom HaShivi'i and by Yom HaShivi'i 2 times. So 3 times you have on the 7th day. And again, this is part of the same process we saw earlier, because Shabbat is actually the ancient Hebrew word, not attested in the Bible, but the ancient Hebrew word for the planet Saturn. Again, another deity from the ancient Near East. We use the Roman word Saturn, the Latin Roman word Saturn in English. And of course, we still call the 7th day of the week Saturday, which comes from Saturn's day, just like Hebrew Shabbat was named for the planet Shabbat or Shabbatai, as we know from later rabbinic texts. So all of this is built into Genesis chapter 1. Now, if we go back to verses 11 and 12, I want to introduce you to a phenomenon well known from ancient Near Eastern texts, the Ugaritic, the Bible, etc., which we call the command and fulfillment pattern, which is to say a character, in this case God, but it could be a deity, it could be a king, commands something, and then you have the repetition of it where the entire thing is fulfilled. Now, you have this in gross form, of course, with the tabernacle account, where for 6 chapters God commands Moses and the people of Israel to build the tabernacle in great detail, and then the intervening chapters of the golden calf story, and then the rest of the book of Exodus giving you the fulfillment of that, almost always with some slight changes, but this various, all the same detail, instead of just saying, and they did it, right? You have six chapters at the end of the book of Exodus. So here's a small version of that. And let's read this together, chapter 1, verse 11. This is the day 3 command for vegetation. Vayomer Elohim, tachei ha'aretz desha, esev mazri azara etz peri oset peri lamino, asher zar ovo al ha'aretz vayichen. And it was so, right? And God said, let the earth vegetate vegetation. Notice the verb desha as a noun is very common in Hebrew, vegetation. But in this case, an atypical verb, tachei. So I translate, let the earth vegetate vegetation, plants that seed, etc. And then in verse 12, it actually happens. Vatotzei, the fulfillment. Vatotzei ha'aretz, even though the end of verse 11 says vayichen, and it was so, verse 12 now gives you those details. Vatotzei ha'aretz desha, esev mazri azera, leminehu, ve'etz osev kari, asher, zar ovo, leminehu, vayar Elohim kito, the refrain. And the earth brought forth vegetation, different verb, plants that seed, etc. Now here you're supposed to pay close attention because you're supposed to see the linguistic virtuosity of our text, of the author of our text. So I've already shown you one of them. In verse 11, it's tachei ha'aretz, using an atypical verb. But when it actually occurs in verse 12 with the common verb to bring forth, vatotzei ha'aretz. And then follow along, you may need your fingers here, deshe, esev, mazri, azera, that's the same in both. But in verse 11, you had lemino later in the verse. Here, the leminehu is placed right after deshe, esev, mazri, azera, and it's not lemino, but a different form, more archaic form, leminehu. And you'll get a second leminehu later on in the verse when verse 11 only has one of them. And again, the eitz, verse 11, eitz peri, oseh peri. Here it's the eitz oseh peri. In the first 11, a fruit tree, or collective, fruit trees that produce fruit. But here in verse 12, trees only that produce fruit. Obviously it's the same thing, but you vary the language every time. And then you have in verse 11, and let me know. And then asher zar ovo, with its seed in it. But in verse 12, you have the opposite, asher zar ovo, coming first, and then lemino, except it's not lemino, it's leminehu. Are you all confused? Did you all follow this, right? This is what the biblical author wants to do, is to have you engage with this text, and to pay attention to all these small details. Now, how were we, in this room, able to do this little exercise? It's because we used our eyes, because we have the text in front of us, or the text projected here on the board, and that's how you and I are able to compare the two passages. But let me remind you now that the ancient reader was not a reader to the text, but was a listener to the text. All ancient literature was processed, was presented orally, and processed with the ears. What I call, in English we have a hard time differentiating these two words, the oral effect. Oral from the mouth, oral into the ear. You have the same in Italian, I assume, right? The same two words. So you have this phenomenon where there was probably a reader, a presenter, even a performer, holding a single text on a papyrus scroll in ancient Israel, later on parchment, who probably in a gathering like this read the text aloud. We live in a world where you have it in print and in digital form. No one in the ancient world had a text in front of him or her. You had to listen. And so the small little differences between verses 11 and 12 had to be captured by a reader slash listener. But that reader listener was primed from early age to listen to a text orally and to know how to process a text in that fashion. We still do this a little bit in our lives with children of a young age who don't know how to read yet, but can listen to a story in a children's book. And if you read a book to your children or in my wife's and my case now, to our grandchildren, and we skip a word, they correct us because they know the text so well orally. None of us in this room can do that anymore because we've learned to read with our eyes. But this is the ancient way. And by the way, this is built into the Bible. In Isaiah chapter 29, first, it's built into the Bible in two ways. In introductory Hebrew course, you learn the verb kara, which we've seen here already in Genesis 1. Kara means what? It means to read, but also to call. Right? It is a word that means to speak loudly, to speak something aloud. So you have, and that also means to read, because everything is done orally. And similarly, the second point I would make is Isaiah chapter 29. In one of the prophecies of the great prophet Isaiah, he envisions a world which will be what we call in English a topsy-turvy world, or an upside-down world, where everything will be reversed. The poor people will be rich, the downtrodden will prosper, the Lebanon, which right now is mountainous, will become farmland, the blind will see, the prisoners will be set free. And then he says, and the deaf will hear the words of the book. Right? That tells you, in our culture, the people who have a disability with reading are the blind people who require special techniques, including Braille, to read. But in ancient Israel, the blind could read by listening. It was the deaf who could not read because they couldn't hear. But Isaiah's prophecy tells us that in that great age to come, the deaf will hear the words of the book. That gives us a sense of how the literary process worked in ancient Israel. And if that were not enough, in verse 29, in day 6, the text returns to the vegetation because humanity and the animal kingdom is now given the plants to eat. We don't get permission to eat meat until after the flood, as you know. And the same phrases appear. I won't go into the details. You can do this on your own, except for one example. All the phrases are used, but they're changed again. And the one change that I've highlighted here for you on the bottom of the page, instead of the hifil form, mazria zera, you have the kal form, zorea zera, apparently meaning the same thing, to seed seed. But again, the text has used a different grammatical form just to keep you, the reader, alert. And once again, remember that we can do this on paper, but the listeners had to do this now, not at a distance of one verse, 11 to 12, but at a distance of 17 more verses before you got to verse 29. Top of the next page. Similarly, Genesis 1:24, when animals are created, the archaic form, which probably would have been a difficult form for even anybody in ancient Israel, chaito eretz, is used. And then in the next verse, that's in the command verse. And in the fulfillment verse, when animals are created, a standard form, chayat haaretz, the animals of the earth, in basic standard Hebrew. So when the variations occur, it can go in either way. The standard, I think, the norm, I think, but I've never done a mathematical study of this, is to put the atypical form first, the archaic form, something like chayto eretz, or the verb tadshe, as we saw on the previous page, where the listener would say, what does that mean? Right? It's not a form that I would use when I speak Hebrew, but then the text corrects itself by explaining chayto eretz is really chayat haaretz, and tadshe becomes batotse in the next common verb that everybody would understand. But it's not always that way, and we saw an example where you have lemino, the standard form in the first case, and then leminehu, the more archaic form in the second case. But these are the workings of the biblical text. The point being, pay attention. Chiasmus. Well, let's start with parallelism. I'm not going to teach you basic biblical parallelism, which is something one learns very early when one studies biblical Hebrew poetry. But I do want to highlight a few instances of some unique features, especially as we're staying with the book of Genesis. Many of my passages come from Genesis, and ditto for the forthcoming book. Chiasmus is used in biblical poetry, and not that every example of chiasmus is as tight and as technical as this one, and not that every one indicates reversal, but this is what you have in Genesis 12, verse 3, because God says to Abraham, the words that you see here, at the beginning of chapter 12, first time God speaks to Abraham, V'avarecha mivarechecha u'mikalelcha aor, right? And let me bless those who bless you, and he who curses you I will damn. Now the chiasmus, the simple chiasmus, is that in the A line you have the verb first and the object second. Let me bless those who bless you. And in the B line, it's reversed. The object comes first. Those who curse you, or he who curses you, I will damn. So that's the basic chiasmus. But look how many other features are changed from the A line to the B line. In the B line, you have the simple future, or. But in the A line, you have what we call the cohortative, okay? The let me form, let me bless them. In the A line, it's those who curse you in the plural. And in the B line, it's he who curses you in the singular. In the A line, you have the same root, bet, resh, kaf, to bless, in both two words. But in the B line, you have two Hebrew synonyms for curse, hof, lamed, lamed, followed by aleph, resh, resh. And so in so many different ways, these two verses, these four words, in a remarkable fashion, provide you all sorts of interchanges and changes and variations to give you the chiastic effect that you're supposed to get from this. One of the great features of biblical poetry, little known, is something we call Janus parallelism. And of course, it's wonderful to speak about Janus parallelism in Rome, because Janus was the Roman god with the two faces looking in both directions. So Janus parallel, and our month January, Enero, what do you say? Genoa, right, is from, named for Janus, looking back to the old year and forward to the new year. And Janus parallelism is when you have three lines of poetry with different meaning in the A line and the C line, so that the B line has to function with the parallel to both the A line and the C line. So you have an example of this in Genesis 15. God says to Abraham, still Avram, Al tira Avram, the A line, do not fear. And then in the B line, Schartar habe ma'od, your reward shall be very great. So the B line uses this word magen, anochi magen lach. Now magen means shield. Everybody knows that word. Magen is shield. Okay, that goes with the A line, right? Don't fear, I'm your shield. I will protect you. But then that leaves the C line all by itself. But if you know Hebrew well, there's a root, mem gimel nun, which means to give or to deliver or to be a benefactor to. It occurs more commonly in the book of Proverbs. It's a poetic word. It really doesn't occur in Hebrew prose. And you're supposed to understand this word here as well, whether it was pronounced magain or in some other form, unclear, but it then links up with the C line because God is your benefactor, your grantor is how I translated it here, which then goes with the reward that you're going to get in the C line. So a single word with two meanings, looks back to the A line and looks forward to the C line. And you may say, well, how would any ancient Hebrew know this word magain could possibly mean grantor in the book of Genesis right here? Well, very nicely, the author of this text, a few verses earlier at the end of Genesis 14, has actually used the word, the only time it ever appears in a Hebrew prose text, Melchizedek, the king of Shalem, the king of Salem, says, Uvaruch el Elyon, Asher Migain Sarecha Biadecha. He actually used the verb right there. You just heard it, you're a listener. You just heard it a few verses earlier. So the verb is actually now in your mind, and then it's used in Genesis 15, verse 1. It goes without saying, or maybe it does go with saying, I need to say this, that those who divide the text into different sources would separate Genesis 15 and Genesis 14 into different sources. And in my reading of this, these are whole unified texts, not to be subdivided into J, E, and P. And therefore, the text allows for the Megain at the end of 14, which is usually not associated with either J, E, or P, an independent source. And that is supposed to link up, in my reading of this, to Genesis 15, as I'm attempting to indicate here for you. Jainist parallelism also occurs beautifully in Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 11. And here you have this beautiful description of the springtime. Hanitzanim nir uva'aretz, the blossoms appear in the land. Eit hazamir higia, v'kol hator nishmar ba'artzenu, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. So you have blossoms in the A line, and you have a songbird in the C line, springtime. And in the B line, you have this word zamir. Zamir means both singing, which links up with the songbirds, and pruning, which links up with the blossoms in the A line. A beautiful example of how Jainist parallelism works in biblical poetry. Let's go to Genesis 15 again, where we just were, and consider these lines. God has spoken, at this point in the text, God has spoken to Abraham four times. Genesis 12, which we looked at a second time in Genesis 12, in Genesis 13, and the very beginning of Genesis 15, as we just saw. These are the four times God has spoken to Abram, still at this point. And they're all the promises, offspring, the land, all the promises that God is granting to Abraham. And Abraham has yet spoken to God. And of course, he's childless. And so finally, Abraham says something in verse 2. And I'll just read it in English. And Abram said, Lord, Lord, what will you give me? And I go childless. And the son domestic, Ben Meshech, of my house is Damesek Eliezer. And I missed the little diacritical mark over the S for the sin, not the samach in Damesek. Come back to those two words in a moment. So after all these promises from God to Abraham, and Abraham never saying a word back and just sort of going along without offspring and so on, finally, he speaks back to God. He says, what good are all these promises? I'm now paraphrasing. What good are all these promises, God, if I go childless? And what happens? God does not respond. And therefore, in verse 3, you have, and Abram said, here you have not given me seed, and behold, the son of my house will inherit me. So if you look at the beginnings of verse 2 and 3, they both begin with Vayomer Avram. Vayomer Avram. Now, we have speeches in the Bible that go more than one verse. We'll see examples. I think we'll see some examples. So that you have Vayomer God. It could be, and God said to Moses, or God said to Abraham, or any speech, or David said to Solomon, or Solomon said to somebody. And you have sometimes a speech that goes two verses, three verses, etc. But it's introduced only once with the Vayomer and the subject. But in this case, you have Vayomer Avram, a series of words, period, full stop, and then Vayomer Avram again. The effect is the following. This is a device which we call, for lack of a better term, Vayomer X, dot, 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 Vayomer X, dot, dot, dot. And the effect is that in between verses 2 and 3, in these cases, you have what we call in English a pregnant pause. Do you want to translate that? Whereas I say something to you and you say nothing back to me, and there's this awkward silence for a moment. That's the effect here, as opposed to Vayomer Avram and then all of verses 2 and 3. Because finally Abraham speaks to God, and you would think that, you know, Abraham's now expecting God's word to come to him again, and it doesn't. And so, okay, well, wait a few seconds, God doesn't say anything, and then Vayomer Avram, and he has to say something else. That's the effect of this. And then, notice how verse 4 is introduced, not with any Vayomer Adonai, and God said to Abraham, but rather, Vehine, Devar Adonai Elav, Lemor. The Vehine there, we'll come back to this, is the way that, in other examples, is the way Abraham perceives the instantaneous, almost shocking voice of God now speaking to him in the second instance. So this is how the biblical text is operating. I underlined two words there, and I just want to point out to you, and we'll come back to this later, the use of alliteration in the biblical text. especially with rare words. Ben Meshech appears only here in the Bible. It's not clear what it means. Ben, of course, we know as son. Ben Meshech, a Hebrew term which must mean something, and then that alliterates with Damesek right after it. So this is a rare, Damascus, so this is a rare form in Hebrew, a unique form, a hapax legomenon. And in used here specifically to give you, to evoke the alliteration, and remember it's all being heard, so you would hear the sounds, and the connection between Ben Meshech and Damesek. And the translation here attempts to capture that in English with an unusual form in English, son domestic, which alliterates with Damascus or Damesek. I did not create that translation. I borrow that with full credit to Everett Fox, who in his English translation did this, and it gets the effect of the Ben Meshech Damesek alliteration. In Genesis 15, God says, verse 16, let's scroll here a little. God says to Abraham, "Vidor ha-rivi'i yashuvu hena, and the fourth generation shall return hither to this place. Ki lo shalem avon ha-emori ad hena, and for the iniquity of the Amorite will not be complete until then." Now, who were the Amorites, and why would you possibly mention the Amorites here, ha-emori? Why not ha-kna'ani, or is it the Canaanite, or some other term? And so the word Amorites appears there as a slight oddity in the text, until we realize later on in chapter 15, verses 19 through 21, that you have a list of the 10 nations that inhabit the land of Canaan, and we have such lists throughout the Bible. This is the only time we have a list of 10 nations, and there is a convention in Hebrew called the 7-10 convention, that in a list of 10 items, item number 10 will always be important, the culmination of the list, but item number 7 is a special slot based on the special quality of the number 7 in the Bible for a special attention. And so in the list of the 10 nations, Ha-Emori is the 7th in that list, because you've just heard it in verse 16, so it connects up. And in at the end of verse 21, the end of the very chapter, Hayibusi, the Jebusite, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, fulfill slot number 10. And you see this elsewhere in the Bible. And I always like to give credit. We should all do this as scholars, but it's certainly an old Jewish tradition to always give credit to the person who came up with the first person to identify such things. And in this case, the 7-10 convention was identified by Amy Jill Levine's former colleague and my close friend and colleague, Jack Sasson, formerly of Vanderbilt and the University of North Carolina, who was the first one to identify the 7-10 convention. Not all of the examples are his. He identified it, and then others have pointed out other examples of it. But this will explain Genesis chapter 5, the genealogy from Adam to Noah, with Noah in the number 10 slot, obviously, but Enoch in the number 7 slot, and not by coincidence, because Enoch will become, must have been an important figure for all of biblical history, even though he's never mentioned again until, of course, the post-biblical period, where he's very prominent, especially in the pseudepigraphic literature. But this also explains Ruth chapter 4, which Professor Sasson pointed out. It's an odd genealogy to get to David. Why start with Perez, of all people? Why not start with Judah, or with Jacob, or Abraham, someone? Why Peretz, a relatively minor character in the Bible? Because if you start with Peretz in the genealogy, that puts Boaz in the 7th slot and David in the 10th slot. Isn't that wonderful? And sorry for the, I don't know what happened. You know what happens when you convert a Word file to PDF. Everything gets messed up. So here's the, interestingly, there's no Hebrew, but somehow all the English didn't format correctly. So what I'm trying to say here is that in the 7th plague, in the 10 plagues, the 7th plague is the most important of the 10, not by coincidence. It's the longest, including the longest divine speech. God speaks for 7 verses in chapter 9, verses 13 through 19, the longest divine speech in the plague's narrative. And then that's plague 7. Of course, plague 10 is very special as well. Top of the next page. Thank you. There are two white sister stories. Chapter 12, the short one, and then in chapter 20. Here's an issue. Chapter 20, verse 2. They're going to Gerar. And Avram says to Sarah, Vayomer Avraham el Sarah ishto ahotihi. And Avram said to Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. Which, of course, makes no sense. He wouldn't say to his wife, she is my sister. So therefore, translators always translate this, and Avraham said about or concerning Sarah, his wife. That is to the people of Gerar, even though the Hebrew preposition there is el, not al. She is my sister. Which, of course, would make sense. But these texts are not always supposed to be easy and make sense. They're supposed to be difficult. And I think what he actually did was say to Sarah, exactly as the Hebrew said, and then he said, Achotihi, she is my sister, which is to say, remember we said, she is my sister when we were in Egypt. Not that that worked out so well, but we're going to do it again now when we go to Gerar. Of course, it doesn't work out so well there either, because Abimelech, fortunately, God appears to Abimelech in a dream, and Abimelech doesn't touch Sarah. And then he calls Abraham in verse 9, and he says, Vayikra Abimelech Abraham, Vayomer lo. A long speech in verse 9, why did you do such a thing? And then no response from Abraham, and therefore verse 10, Vayomer Abimelech el Abraham. Exactly what we saw before, you see it again here. Abraham has no response to Abimelech. What's he going to say? Right? So he just, Abimelech has to speak again in verse 10. Then Abraham responds, and he says in verse 12, and indeed, in truth, she is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And I said to her, do this chesed for me, this kind deed, do this chesed for me, and when we travel, pretend that we are brother and sister. But in fact, we are brother and sister. He apparently married his half-sister. Now, everybody thinks that he's creating something of a white lie here, but I think that this is actually the truth, that he married his half-sister. First of all, notice in Leviticus 20, in the laws of incest, that the word chesed is used in its reverse meaning, not as a good deed, but as a bad deed. If you marry your sister, this is the only time it's used in Leviticus 20. If you marry your sister, it is a chesed, which doesn't mean a good act. It means a bad act, a bad deed. And in fact, the word is so rare, the bottom line of this page, that the author of the Temple Scroll, when he used this verse, changed chesed to toeva, meaning abomination, which is used elsewhere in Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20, giving you an indication that this is indeed an odd usage. But notice Abraham used the word chesed, and the word chesed is actually related to brother-sister marriage. Now, top of the next page, are they really brother and sister? Can we show this? Well, we can't really show it, but what's striking is that the genealogy in Genesis 11, we get all sorts of information about Nahor's wife. We get no information about Abraham's wife. We learn her name, Sarai, later to become Sarah, but we don't know who her father was, we don't know who her mother was, we don't know anything about her. And the contrast is very loud between all the information we're giving about Nahor's wife, Milcah. We learn the name of her family members, but we don't learn anything about Sarah at all. That's because the author has withheld this information. If you had learned in Genesis 11 that Sarah was actually the half-sister of Abraham, then this would ruin the story for you in Genesis 12 and in Genesis 20, in the wife-sister stories. It turns out they really are brother and sister in this kind of relationship, which of course would later on be prohibited according to Leviticus 18 and 20. What this means is that there are times when readers and characters have different knowledge. In most storytelling, the reader of the story knows the same information that the characters know. So that when it says that Abraham journeyed from Ur to Haran to Canaan, Abraham knows this and you know it at the same time. Or when God says to Moses such and such, Moses learned it and you learned it at the same time. But you get examples where the characters have knowledge where you don't have it. Abraham and Sarah knew this all along, but you, the reader, did not. Similarly, in Genesis 34, you're reading the story thinking, well, Dinah must have come home to her family, but you learn at the end of the story in verse 26 that the whole time that the negotiations were going on, Dinah was still in the palace of Shechem because the brothers had to take her out of the house of Shechem in verse 26. You lost track of where she was during the whole story because she disappears after the first few verses. But you learn now that she was actually still in the palace the whole time. The sons of Jacob knew this. You, the reader, were not aware of this. Or the opposite can occur. In Genesis 22, verse 1, most famously, God tested Abraham. Who knows that? You and I know that. We're reading the story. We know this is just a test. Abraham's not really going to go sacrifice Isaac. But Abraham doesn't know this is a test. He thinks this is real. He only hears God tell him to go sacrifice your son, your beloved son Isaac. You and I, the reader, have been told in advance that it's a test. And the reason the author of Genesis 22 informs us of this information is because he doesn't want us, if we knew that this was, if we didn't know this was a test, we would be worried about Isaac. Of course, our emotions would go to Isaac. What's going to happen? We want to follow Abraham and see what Abraham does. And of course, Abraham passes the test with a perfect score. So you get these different knowledges between characters and readers. In the story of David and Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite, you don't know who Uriah is. You might just think he's a common soldier. Not until the very end of the book of Samuel, in chapter 23, do you learn that, in fact, Uriah is one of David's great heroes, which, of course, makes us think about going back and reading that story again in a new light. He's not just a low soldier. He's actually one of the great 37 heroes in David's army, as we learn in chapter 23. In chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, pausing here for a moment for something really wonderful, you have the word kings spelt, pronounced Milachim, according to the Aleppo Codex, Malachim, according to the St. Petersburg Codex, once upon a time, and still by many scholars called the Leningrad Codex. But notice the extra aleph in there. Very odd spelling, as if it were the word for messengers, angels or messengers. So you read the word kings. So I hold the text and I will say it's the time when kings go out, milachim. But only I, you don't know this because you don't have a text in front of you, I get to see the aleph there. I know to read it, milachim. I know what the oral reading tradition is. But I actually see the word in my text with the aleph suggesting the word messengers. Why? Because messengers will play such a key story a key role in the story of David and Bathsheba. Messengers are sent back and forth between David and Bathsheba and the palace and Uriah and so on. And Joab. All the characters send messengers. Okay, Genesis 27, next page. Now, let's look at this story, and I know that I'm going to have to either skip some material or speed up some material. So let's try to work through this as best as we can in the time we have. In Genesis 27, fortunately you all know the stories. In Genesis 27, Isaac instructs Esau to go and hunt some game and bring him the meat, and then he will eat and give him the blessing. And he says, verse 4, Ba'avor, near the end of verse 4, Ba'avor tivarechecha nafshi, that my nefesh, inner being, life force, however you want to translate nefesh, may bless you. Rebecca overhears this, and she says in verse 7 to Jacob, go do this, prepare some mat'amim, some delicacy, some tasty food, that I, she's speaking now as if she heard Jacob, she heard Isaac's words, that I may bless you. Before Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh, before Yahweh, before the Lord. Isaac never said that. Rebecca says that. Rebecca introduces the divine name here when she repeats the words that she heard Isaac say to Esau. Does this have more to do with women's spirituality, perhaps? I don't answer the question, but I just raise the possibility here. And then in verse 10, she says to Jacob still, and you'll bring them to your father, and he will bless you before his death. Fine. You all know what happens. Jacob goes, gets the meat, kills the goat, gets the meat, dresses up, goes before Isaac, his father, and he says, I did as you spoke to me, pretending to be Esau, of course. Arise, please, sit and eat of my hunting game, in order that your nephesh may bless me. Rebekah never used the word nephesh when she spoke to Jacob. How did Jacob know that actually Isaac used the word nephesh when he spoke to Esau? Everybody see that? We don't know the answers to these questions. Jacob knew his father so well that he knew that he would use that expression. It's the same expression. He said back in verse 4, Ba'avor tivarechecha nafshi, not that Jacob heard those words, but when he repeats the words, he uses the same phrase. Ba'avor, verse 19, tivarecheni nafshecha. Fascinating. In verse 11, 12, 13, bottom of the page, Jacob objects to Rebekah. Yaakov said to Rivka, his mother, Esau is a hairy man, and I'm a smooth man. I am chalak. Perhaps I will be as a mocker in mitatea, and he'll curse me and not bless me. And Rebekah said, upon me your curse, a lie, verse 13, a lie, kilalatcha b'ni. Okay, let your curse be upon me. We'll come back to that in just a moment. First of all, notice the alliteration between mitatea and matamim, right? Exactly what we've talked about. Matamim occurring multiple times in the text. I've noted that on the next page as well, but it's already, we heard it earlier. And this word mitatea, so rare words alliterating with one another. But I want to focus on the word chalak for a moment. Jacob says, I'm chalak. Top of the next page. Well, this word has three meanings. Chalak means smooth skin, its basic meaning. But as we know from Proverbs chapter 26, it also means smooth talking. You have an expression like that in Italian. In English, smooth talking means you're not always honest. And one thing we learn about Jacob is he's not always honest, right? He tricks Esau twice, actually, right? Back in chapter 25, here in chapter 27. So he's chalak. I'm a smooth talker. You could use that word for Odysseus, perhaps, in the Odyssey, right? He's always called similar terms by Homer. And then in Joshua chapter 11, we learn that there is a mountain, verse 17, there's a mountain, chalak, which is the border between Israel and Edom. Where, think about what he said, I'm an ish chalak. I'm an Israelite. I'm the father of Israel. I'm an ish chalak. And my brother Esav is the father of Edom. He is Seir, hairy, Mount Seir. All these word plays happening in this particular text. And there's that word matamim. Now, if you do something like Jacob and Rebekah did, you should be punished for it. You shouldn't trick people like this and acquire blessings through such means. So when people do bad acts in the Bible, they can be punished immediately. God can do this in Genesis 38 immediately. We don't know what Er did, but God killed him immediately. We know what Onan did. God killed him immediately. Or the punishments can be played out by human characters. It doesn't necessarily mean God has to punish them. So what happens to Rebekah and Jacob? Well, when Jacob goes off to the house of Laban in Genesis 29, and what happens? Laban does what? He takes the firstborn and places her before the secondborn. He puts Leah in the place where Rachel should have been. And when Jacob wakes up in the morning and complains, he says, why did you do this? And Laban says, one of the great verses of the Bible, Lo ye aseh kein bimkomenu, lateh hatseira lifnei habechira. It is not done thus in our place. I know what you did back in your place. It is not done thus in our place to give the younger before the firstborn. And how did Laban know about this? Well, because earlier in this story, he didn't read the news, hear the news on CNN. Earlier in the story, it tells him that Jacob, the text says that Jacob told him all these things. Well, he must have told him his story. One day your nephew shows up hundreds of miles from home. So he told him what happened, I guess. And so that's the revenge against Jacob. And Rebecca, how's her punishment? How many of you know this? After Genesis 27, Rebecca never again appears in the story. She never got to see her beloved son again. Jacob had to move away from home for 20 years. When he returns home, by the way, I don't think it's a coincidence, Odysseus was also away from home, from Ithaca for 20 years. Jacob was away for 20 years, and when he comes home, he's reunited with Esau. They make peace. He's reunited with Jacob, and he's present with Isaac, his father, and together the two sons bury their father, Isaac. But he never sees his mother again. And there's no death notice for her. There's no burial notice for her. We learn of the deaths and burials of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and of Sarah and Rachel, but we never see a notice about Rebekah. And the camera went with us to the land of Aram with Jacob, and in those intervening 20 years, we have to assume that Rebekah died. But the text doesn't want to, so she's totally omitted from the record because she was the one who orchestrated the deception of Isaac. But the text wants to give us a little reminder in Genesis 35. And it reminds us that Deborah, the wet nurse of Rebekah, died. So we get to hear the name Rebekah, even though we don't know whatever happened to Rebekah, and she must have died in those 20 years. But her old nursemaid, Deborah, was still alive. Not the famous Deborah of the Bible in the book of Judges, a lesser known Deborah from the book of Genesis. Okay, chapter 29. The Jacob and Rachel story. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to have to skip this chapter. And let's move on to the bottom of page 10 and talk about alliteration. And there are multiple chapters in my book and a few articles I've already published on the subject. Again, because of the orality of the text, the biblical authors would reach deep into the Hebrew lexicon and they would choose words that you and I would not use on a daily basis and which the ancient readers wouldn't use either. And all great writers, I know the English literary tradition, and if you read Shakespeare, there is alliteration everywhere in Shakespeare. So this is just part of the tradition, right? So I'll give you an expression which is very hard and uses a couple of, not a, a very fancy English word, but in the play Henry V, Shakespeare refers to one of the characters as magnanimous as Agamemnon. Everybody hear that? Magnanimous, meaning great, as Agamemnon. Well, he was probably also as magnanimous as Achilles or any one of the other characters from Homer, but magnanimous as Achilles doesn't work, right? But magnanimous as Agamemnon. We could all practice saying that. It's very difficult to say, right? That's the orality that you hear of the alliteration. The biblical authors do the same thing. So Jeremiah chapter 2, a very unusual Hebrew word, kilulot, meaning... Oh, I didn't translate these passages. Kilulot, meaning something like wedding or betrothal or marriage, used only here in the Bible. Nowhere else. A hapax. Kilulotayach. This beautiful passage from Jeremiah. Kilulotayach. And it alliterates with the very next word, lechtech. You're going. So this is part of the tradition. 1 Samuel chapter 19, the only place this word occurs in the Bible. Lahakat. The expression here is lahakat ha-nevi'im, a group of prophets. Why use lahakat? Well, look at the other words, common words. Lakahat in particular, and also assisting with the alliteration later in the verse, Malachi Shaul, the messengers of Saul. Top of the next page, one of my favorites, and we should all have favorite passages in the Bible, right? One of my favorites. In Judges chapter 14, the author easily could have used the word Shemesh, thereby evoking the name of Shimshon, Samson, the main character. But the author passed on that because he had a better alliteration. Vayomru lo, anshei ha'ir, and the men of the city said to him, Vayom ha'shivi'i, on the seventh day, this is before they had to solve the riddle, Biterem yavo ha'charsa, before the sun had set. But it's not Shemesh, which again would be wonderful with Shimshon, Samson, it's charsa, a word that appears only one other place in the Bible, meaning sun. And then they solve the riddle, Mama tok midvash, what is sweeter than honey and what is stronger than the lion? And Samson said to them, Vayomir lahem, lulei harashtem ve'eglati, lo mitzatem chidati. If you had not plowed with my heifer, and that's a sexual innuendo, if you had not played with my girl or something like that, you would not have found out my riddle. Right? So charsa is used because of charashtem in the verse. In Genesis 21, Sarah says, verse 7, when she gives birth, Vatomer, and she said, Mi milel la'Avraham, who would say to Abraham, using milel, of all the words for speech in the Bible, and you know them, amar, higid, diber, all these words for speech in the Bible, here you have milel, the only place it is used outside of poetry. We know it from the book of Job. It's the common word in Aramaic to speak. The Targumim use milel when they want to translate the Hebrew word amar frequently. Mi milel la Abraham. Why would the text have Sarah use that word? Because it alliterates with, in verse 4, Vayamol Abraham, he circumcised his son, and in verse 8, Vayigamal. And he was weaned, and later on Gamal appearing also in verse 8. So this is the way of the biblical text. Form follows content very commonly throughout the Bible. Genesis 39, verse 1 through 6, Joseph in the house of Potiphar, and all of the blessings that come to the house of Potiphar, because Joseph is in his house, and God makes Joseph successful, and therefore everything in Potiphar's house. This could have been said in one verse. One verse, that's all you needed to say it. You know, and everything went well in Potiphar's house because Joseph was there and God blessed Joseph in Potiphar's house. Enough. But it has to go on for six verses because the bounty, the blessing, the prosperity, all of that that's happening in Potiphar's house, and all these phrases that are used over and over again in the English translation I've underlined, v'chol yeshlo, v'chol asherlo, all that was his, all that was his, all these things are being blessed. And so flowery language, beautiful language, repetitive language to show the bounty and the prosperity in the household. as long as we're in chapter 39, oh, wait, did I go too far? Right, as long as we're in chapter 39, let's see if I can get these both on the screen at the same time. Well, I can't, okay. So, verse 6 says the following. On the previous page. Vayazov kol asher lo biyad Yosef, v'lo yada ito mi'uma, ki im halechem asher hu ochel. And he left all that was all which was his in the hand of Joseph, and he knew naught, or he knew naught with him, except for the bread which he eats. Apparently, the Egyptians wouldn't trust non-Egyptians to prepare their food, and so Joseph could be in charge of everything in the household, but not the food of Potiphar. That had to be left to a Egyptian. This is very common, and anthropologists know this, in societies of the world, you only eat the food that is prepared by your people of your own culture. Now, when Joseph repeats these words in verse 9 to Potiphar's wife, he says, "Eninu gadol b'bayit hazeh, there's no one greater in this house, me many, than I." Which is already an exaggeration, of course, because Potiphar is greater. "V'lo chasach mi menu me'uma," and he has not withheld from me naught, repeating the phrase from verse 6, ki'im otach ba'asher atishto, except for you, because you are his wife. But in verse 6, it was the lechem, it was the bread that he couldn't prepare. And here, Joseph says, I'm in charge of everything except you, his wife. And the answer to this is that lechem, bread, food, in ancient Hebrew, is a euphemism for a woman or a wife, especially with sexual innuendo. And this was again pointed out by Rashi, the great medieval commentator, and we have other passages in the book of Proverbs and in post-biblical Hebrew where these phrases actually appear. But you have to really know a lot about the Hebrew language to get these meanings. Another example, returning to form follows content, Joshua chapter 2, the scene of the spies. All spies have to do things in secrecy and quiet, right? These spies don't do that very well because they're found out as soon as they're in the house of Rahab. But the biblical text uses Bahoshech, Balila, and Cheresh. It uses these words to connote the darkness and the secrecy of spies going out to spy the city of Jericho. Confused language. Intentionally confused language. Now in verse 4, Vatikach ha'isha et shnei ha'anashim vatitzpeno. And the woman took the two men and she hid him. Everybody see the difficulty? She took the two men. You would expect vatitzpenein, and she hid them. But no, and she hid him. Why? Most English translations, I assume in all languages of the world, translated, and she hid them, because you want to make sense of the text. But the text says, and you read the Hebrew, and she hid him, and we have to deal with that. What's the answer here? The answer is that the woman, Rahab, is speaking to the king's messengers at her door during this whole interchange here, and I've given you verses 3, 4, and 5, and 6. She's actually speaking to the men at the door. How can she possibly hide them at the same time? And the answer is, of course, no man could do this, but women are better multitaskers, so that she would be able to do that and hide them. Not fully. She's a superwoman. That's part of the portrayal of Rahab, right? The lowly who's elevated to superwoman and hero of Israel. She can't quite hide both of them, but she can, you know, do this maybe and tell them to hide while she's speaking. So she did her best and she hid him, one of them. The other reason, and some translations say, by the way, and she had hid them. But that's not what the Hebrew says. It's not the pluperfect. It's the standard narrative past tense, and she hid him. When Hebrew wants to do the pluperfect, it can do that in verse 6, where it says, v'hi ha'elatam ha'gaga, and she had taken them up to the roof. That is the pluperfect, and I translated that in English. She had taken them. But in verse 4, it's she took. But of course, she can only hide the one as best as she possibly could. And this is because of the heroism of this incredible woman who's able to do all of these actions at once. The other reason to have, and she hid him, is that this expression appears one other time in the Bible. And I've given it to you here in a very common, very well-known story, Exodus chapter 2, where Moses' mother hid him. There are many evocations in the book of Joshua, the early chapters of Joshua, to the story of the Exodus. So if you go through all of Joshua, there's a Passover story, there's a splitting of the Jordan River, there is a manna story. All of those stories repeat the stories that you saw. Oh, there is the angel appearing to Joshua who tells him to remove your shoes, you're standing on holy ground. All of those expressions you know, and all of those motifs you know from Exodus. And so similarly here, you have to be brought back to Exodus. The last time you heard, and she hid him, is when Moses' mother hid him in the basket in Exodus chapter 2, verse 2. But here I call your attention to the following. And now you really need to know your Hebrew grammar. Can I get both on the screen? Yes. This is the standard form, vatitzpenehu. That is the third person masculine singular object placed on a wayektol form. Those of you who study all your Hebrew grammar. Vatitzpeno in verse 4 is the wrong object, is the wrong form. It would be saying that gets attached to nouns and pronouns. It would be like saying, and she hid his, instead of and she hid him. And so this is the way the text shows you that there's a confusion in the moment when she hears the door knock and she has to talk to the king's messengers and hide these two men, one of which she can barely hide by using the wrong object form. All of that from Batitzpanel. A tremendous amount packed in to a single passage. Okay, let's, in the interest of time again, let's go down to, and you can ask me any questions about some of the material I've skipped when we're finished in a few minutes. Let's go down to page 14, Foreign Tinge. All story writers do this. You can write a novel in English, and if the novel's set in France, you have people say bonjour in the morning. You have people eat a baguette, right? You can say it in English, right? You want to give a sense that you're in a foreign land, even though you're writing in English. Similarly, the biblical authors, they're writing in Hebrew, but when the scene goes to Aram in Genesis 24, when Abraham's servant goes to find a wife for Isaac, or in Genesis 30 and 31, when Jacob goes to live in Aram, many Aramaic forms are used. I can only give you one example here. Luz, the Aramaic word for almond. Not the Hebrew word shakei, but the word luz. Just to give you a sense, okay, we're in the land of Aram. So there must have been sufficient Hebrew speakers who would know a few Aramaic words, just like as an English speaker, I know bonjour in French, and I know how to say grazie in Italian, and prego, and so on, without really speaking Italian. I know enough because I'm an educated person, and so that's what these authors do in these texts. Similarly, when Bilam, an Aramean prophet, comes to the land of Canaan, he will speak Hebrew, but with Aramaic tinges. And instead of saying mamlacha for kingdom, says malchut for kingdom, which will become Hebrew in the Persian period and in post-biblical Hebrew, but this is the only place it appears in pre-exilic Hebrew prose. Otherwise, it's always mamlacha, kingdom. Here you see malchut. When the prophets speak to the other kingdoms, other countries, kingdoms of the world, Israel's neighbors, the prophets will use words from those places. So when Zechariah speaks to Tyre, first of all, notice the alliteration, Tzor, Matzor, Tzibor, and Harutz. I've transliterated all of them for you. But the key word there is Harutz. That's the Phoenician word for gold. We know it from Phoenician and Ugaritic, also from Akkadian actually comes. The Greek word chrysos is related. Hebrew, it's zahav. I'm not going to speak to the Phoenicians and use the word zahav. I'm going to speak to them and say charutz, because God, through his prophet, is speaking to the Phoenicians. I'm going to use their word. And similarly, Ezekiel, when he speaks to Tyre in chapter 26, umatzvot uzech la'aretz terei. And the pillars, my mistake, I translated it as pillars as if I was thinking Hebrew. It's pillar, singular. Notice the verb, terei, is third person, feminine, singular. It should be, and the pillar of your strength, because in Phoenician, feminine singular nouns end in a taf, and they end in ot. Probably they distinguished short ot from long ot, for the plural, but the short ot, matzvot, here is singular, as you can tell from the verb. That's Phoenician grammar, and it gets built into Ezekiel 26. And Jeremiah chapter 50, for the gathering of Assyriologists here in the room, Jeremiah uses this word, oshioteha, which is the Akkadian word asitu, meaning a tower, or a bastion, or a city wall, or something like that, instead of using Hebrew migdol, or choma, or choma is used also in the verse. So Asitu of Akkadian is borrowed here because he's addressing the city of Babylon. Let's go to the bottom of 15. Other examples of variation in the final component to mark closure. As I said at the beginning, Genesis chapter 1 has this. Look at Psalm 115. The mockery of the idols. From the psalmist. A mouth they have, they do not speak. Eyes they have, they do not see, etc., etc. In all of these, the body part comes first. Mouth, eyes, ears, nose, hands, feet, and then the verb, except for the last one. Lo yehagu bigronam. They do not utter in their throat. You've reached the end of the list of body parts, so you switch the word order, verb first, and then the word for throat. Other examples of this, top of the next page. Ruth chapter 1. You all know the verse. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people, my people. Your God, my God. Wherever you die, I will die. And now you would expect what? And wherever you will be buried, I will be buried. X, Y, X, Y, X, Y, X, Y, etc. The last one is simply the Y. Visham ekaver. And there I will be buried. That's the end of the long list of Ruth's beautiful words to Naomi. Numbers chapter 1. There could be nothing more boring than a census of the people of Israel. None of us reads through Numbers chapter 1. We just skip it. But notice how all the tribes are introduced. Livnei Shimon, Livnei Gad, all of them are always introduced with the Lamed. Until you get to the last one, verse 42, it's simply B'nai Naphtali, without the Lamed. Intentional variation at the end of a long list of 12 tribes, giving you just the Lamed. The Samaritan Torah, by the way, harmonizes here and puts the Lamed in. And the versions have to express some preposition, as do most translations into modern language. Variation in general is where we'll end. I started out with this in the command and fulfillment passages of Genesis 11, chapter 1. And notice when verses repeat in Song of Songs, for example, many of the expressions repeat. Never once in all of Song of Songs do we get a verbatim repetition. There's always some variation. Ki cholat ahava ani, shecholat ahava ani. Smolo tahat l'roshi, smolo tahat roshi. With the lamed, without the lamed. Genesis 19. Pay attention to this one. Lot's two daughters. Verse 31. Vatishkena et abihen yayin balayla. That's in verse 33. In verse 35. Vatashkena gam balayla hahu. So, of course you're going to use the word gam now. The first expression, balayla hu. Atypical Hebrew. In verse 35, it's corrected, right? To balayla hahu. Et Abihen appeared earlier in verse 33. In verse 35, it appears after the at nighttime. Et Abihen. Yayin, and then Yayin, right? So Et Abihen Yayin is moved between verse 33 and verse 35. In verse 33, the verb is Vatavo. In verse 35, it's Vatakon. Obviously, verse 33, it's the firstborn, Habdechira, and in verse 35, it's the younger, Hatsi'ira. Verse 33, Vatishkav et Aviha, and she lay with her father. And verse 35, Vatishkav imo, and she lay with him. And now look at the bottom of the page. Et Aviha, verse 33, will resonate in verse 37 with Moav, the offspring of the first incestuous union. And verse 35, Emo, will resonate in verse 38 with Amon, the second offspring, of the offspring of the second illicit relationship. The biblical authors did everything as I am attempting to show you. These three verses on the top of page 17, similar but different, including very unusual expressions. Chapter 26, verse 30, Har Eta. How many times do you encounter a Hof'al second masculine singular form in the Bible? I think this is the only one of the common verb Ra'ah that you will see in the Bible. Yes, even the author of priestly material can engage in alliteration. 29 verse 1, V'zeha davar asher ta'aseh lahem l'kadesh otam l'chahen li. This is the matter which you should do to them, the priests, to sanctify them, to then serve as priests, lekahen. And instead of kach, the imperative, take, lekach. And again, you've learned Hebrew grammar, and then you get to this verse, and you say, that's not how you say take in Hebrew. You say kach, imperative. Here it's lekach. Why? Lekadesh, lekahen, lekach. You hear the sounds. The laws of the various festivals in Leviticus 23. The standard one, because it appears twice, is the one for Pesach and the one for Yom Kippur. They are the same. Chukat olam ledorotechem b'chol moshvotechem. But notice what happens in the Shavuot law. The two expressions are reversed. Chukat olam b'chol moshvotechem ledorotechem. And in the Shabbat law, only moshvotechem and not for your generations. And in the Sukkot law, ledorotechem, without the in all your dwellings. You keep changing it up. And for the italics there, month 7, day 1 festival, which becomes Rosh Hashanah in later Jewish tradition, there's no formula whatsoever. We have the least information about that holiday, just omit the formula. But the formula is changed up all the time in these verses. I'll leave you with Amos chapters 1 and 2. Wherever you see the repeated refrains and the same phraseologies, and you know Amos' words to the foreign nations, I will send forth fire, etc. They're always changed, right? There is always going to be some difference. It's either the house of this or the city wall of that. Things will constantly be different in the fifth one, verse 14. Instead of, I will send forth fire, the most radical change, behitzati esh, I will incite fire, I will cause fire to be against the city wall of Rabbah, and so on. And we end with my all-time favorite biblical verse. I told you, you all need to have favorite verses, okay? And then amongst your favorite verses, you can have one favorite. Ezekiel 37. Well-known passage. The vision of the dry bones appears right before this. It's evoked, of course, in many, many later Jewish and Christian texts and Jewish and Christian art and so on, down to this day. So God, right after that, God says to Ezekiel to take two pieces of wood, and on one you write Israel, and on the other you write Judah. Actually, you write Judah on one and Joseph on the other, and you put the two together, and the two pieces of wood are going to form a diptych, and they are symbolic of the reunion of Israel and Judah in the exile and in the post-exilic period to be a single kingdom again under the house of David. That's Ezekiel's message. Now look at the text. To Joseph, for the first one concerning Judah, he says, Kach lecha etz echad. In the second go-round, Likach, there's that word again. Likach eitz echad. No lecha, omitted. And kach, standard, becomes likach. Why? Because likach is the northern Hebrew form to take, which we know from a few places in the Bible. The Elisha story set in northern Israel. Here, referring to the kingdom of Israel in the second part of the verse. And it would be used, as we saw earlier in Exodus 29, not because that's a northern source, but because the Judean author was able to use it for alliterative purposes. So, kach lecha etz echad, in the second instance, ulekach etz echad. Uchtov alav, those are the same, although the tradition gives you different spellings for ketov. Alav, lihuda, fine, liyosef, fine. And the A line concludes with, Vilivne Yisrael Chaverav, but the B line concludes with Eitz Ephraim, which is blank in the A line. I left the blank space. Eitz Ephraim in the B line. V'chol Beit Yisrael Chaverav. So different expressions, right? It's not Beit Yisrael Chaverav. It's Livne Yisrael Chaverav with a lamed. And here in the B line, no lamed. V'chol Beit Yisrael Chaverav. I hope you're following all these very minor changes in what is a beautiful theological message that God gives to the prophet Ezekiel concerning the entirety of the people of Israel, all 12 tribes. And in this great message, the biblical text uses these small changes, variations from the A line to the B line, to have you pay attention to what is one of the great passages in the Bible. Thank you. My mistake, I said thank you, I meant grazie.
Thank you very much, Professor Ransford, for several things. For the clarity with which you spoke, because you're speaking to an international audience, and so we were able to follow you, even the quick remarks, you heard them laughing, so they were able to follow you. You prepared an extraordinary handout, so that again, in an international setting, you took the time to give that to us, so we could follow you so clearly.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You give us also your time. But most importantly, I think, you told us to pay attention. And that's what we do here at this institute. We struggle to pay attention to the text as deeply as possible. But what you really did was, by giving us examples, was yourself, you incarnated this morning for us the attention to the text that you are calling forth from us. So really, thank you very much for this very, very stimulating, brilliant lecture. I think if we could have 10 minutes, just 10 minutes, if there's any response or question, someone wants to intervene, if somebody wants to speak in Italian, I can try to translate it. Does anyone have something they really want to? Yes, Michael.
Well, thank you very much. There are a lot of details here. And I think noticing these small changes it's also open to many different interpretations. For instance, you made a comment on the difference between kach lekach etz and lekach etz. Here you state that this slight variation is a northern imperative, whereas in a previous one you said that it was just simply added. The lamed.
Right.
So I can see that noticing these changes, these small changes, requires from us an interpretation. The other one that I like, your very first one, where the judgment that God saw that it was good was missing day two. Your explanation is that the mayim represents chaos, and so therefore there isn't a judgment there. But I really like that. But also, in the very first day, you have the creation of light. God said that there was light. And we have immediately the judgment that it was good. Then the separation of light from darkness and no judgment that it was good. Then on the sixth day, I love this. On the sixth day, we have two creations, the creation of the land animals and the creation of the humans.
Right.
After the land animals, just like in day one, you have the judgment. God saw that it was good, the land animals. Then for the humans, there is no judgment, except at the very end of day six, and God saw everything that he made was very good. No, all I'm saying is these differences require from us quite a bit of interpretation. I'm just confirming what you're saying.
Well, thank you. First of all, it's wonderful to have the first question from a fellow North American, so I can follow the question so beautifully. Yes, if I didn't stress that enough, look, this is about the use of language for literature. But what I tried to stress, and you're absolutely correct, maybe I didn't stress it enough, it's not just because we want to show how good we are at writing a language and using a language, although that's clearly part of the intent here. You are demanded to interpret these texts as you go along. And I think it also has to do with the process of reading, if I may say this again. So we read silently, right? And we all do this, right? We get ready for bed, we climb into bed, we have our book, and we fall asleep within minutes or seconds. Am I right? We all do this. This is the nature of being a human today. And we're not engaging with the text if we fall asleep, or maybe we read the same paragraph twice because we're getting tired, and then we just give up, and then we put the book down and turn the light off and we go to sleep. You couldn't do that with these texts. You had to be engaged and understand and interpret, and exactly as you suggested, do all of this thinking as you proceed. Deep thinking about what these texts really mean. It really is a phenomenal. It's a phenomenal process.
We need to hear that homily often.
Right, and we do. Amen.
anyone else want? Yes, Gus.
Just to echo your things of Genesis 1. When there is no judgment in the Masoretic text, so the Greek has it. Now, about the rakia. Rakia, on that particular day, there was no judgment that God saw the expanse. Now, do you think what I think then? That it is a kind of foreshadowing of the entrance back of the waters in Genesis 6, because as a punishment. So the rakia, the sky was not perfect from the beginning. So it could be penetrated by violence. There, Hamas in the chapter 6 of Genesis. Right. So that's a kind of using your literary kind of the approach that may fit well with that. That
right.
So kind of foreshadowing.
Here's our word rakia.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is then used in Genesis 6 for the flood.
Not so much, right? But the
is rakia used?
No.
It's not used, right? But the shamayim is used, right?
Yeah. Water would come back through the openings.
Right. So that's really lovely. Thank you for that. So if you didn't hear, Professor Gianta's suggestion is that there's also no goodness, no statement of goodness to the Rakia, Shamayim, and the Mayim, because that will be the destructive force in Genesis 6 with the flood, which means that this is a type of foreshadowing for what will occur later on. I like that very, very much, and thank you for that. If I ever mention this again, I will quote you, as we say in Hebrew, B'shem Omro, in the name of the man who said it, or the woman who said it, but in this case, B'shem Omro. And thank you, it's beautiful. That's exactly the kind of process that I think we need to do more of when we read these texts.
And that is certainly what we're trying to do here. I just have one final question, then, and I'll let you go. So, we find out at the end of 2 Samuel that Uriah is really one of David's top people. So why does he ask who is that woman? Do you think he knew who she was all the time?
Oh,
and he's really playing with, who is that woman being? As the wife of your general. Do you think he knew, is that a... It's a very good insight. At the very end of the story,
right?
We find
out... So he's playing all along.
What was he? What's your thought? Do you think
on the surface, I would say he really does not know who this is, because it's one thing to know the men in your army and in your palace. Knowing their wives may be a little different, because women typically didn't participate in the upper echelons of society,
right.
And they were in their own private homes, which would have been luxurious homes if she was the wife of Uriah. So maybe he didn't know her. That would be a surface reading, but a deeper reading, which you're suggesting here, is that he always did know who she was, and he has to pretend for the purposes of himself,
right,
inside the story, that he really doesn't know who she is. I like that a lot. So, Craig, yeah, that's really wonderful. Right? And there are no answers to these questions, right? I mean, this is...
But it's just very interesting that that is held to the end.
Yeah.
And then you go,
that's
that guy again.
Right. Yeah. So, thank you.
You have taught us to pay attention, and we will pay attention remembering this lecture and the time you gave us. So thank you once again.
And I'll just say one more thank you on behalf of my wife Melissa this year and myself to Craig Morrison, who has escorted us to the Vatican Library, and with whom we've shared some wonderful times here during our week in Rome. And just thank you for all the hospitality and for the entire institute. And the only words are mille grazie, grazie tanto. Okay. Thank you.